Okay, good afternoon, everyone. It is my pleasure to introduce our next speaker, Eric Dong, who is a PhD student in the School of Risk and Actuarial Studies at UNSW. Eric is currently working on uncertainty quantification using neural networks, and his focus is on distributional regression and Bayesian deep learning, with a goal of designing neural networks that can embed expert knowledge, which sounds very impressive to me, so that models not only learn safely from data, but also they can signal when they're confident, and conversely, when decisions should be made with caution. That sounds like a very lofty goal, and I can't wait to see you fulfill it. Eric's talk today is going to take us beyond traditional GLMs, exploring how modern approaches can quantify different types of uncertainty with practical implications for actuaries. Please join me in welcoming Eric.
Thank you. Thank you for the warm introduction. My name is Eric, and I'm glad to be here. Can everyone hear me at the back here? Yeah, good. All right, so today my topic is uncertainty quantification in neural network models. So I'm going to start with a bit of motivation. So think about you're driving this car, right? And right in front of you, you see a car which is braking. And you're driving in thick fog, so there's a lot of invisibility, right? And you need to essentially make a decision here, right? Do you just keep driving? Do you want to brake lightly or brake harder? Or do you want to change a lane, right? And that truthfully reflects the uncertainty that we always encounter in real life. And for actuaries, this is particularly most likely what we're encountering every day, right? We have lots of uncertainty. We can't see the bigger picture. So there's a decision to be made. So let's try to break it down, right? And today's talk is trying to get ourselves familiar with two types of uncertainty and see how machine learning can come into play, specifically deep learning comes into play to help us quantify those uncertainty. So the first type of uncertainty is epistemic uncertainty. So you might think on the other side of the road or the other line, is there going to be an upcoming car? What's actually happening beyond the fog, right? There's invisibility, so you hope for more transparency in this case. But these are the lack of knowledge, right? The part that if there's a better weather, maybe we get to know these uncertainty better. There's also the other side, right, which is aleatoric uncertainty, which actuaries inevitably have to deal with. That is, we're not sure about how the car right in front of us is going to brake, like the braking force, right? How long it's going to brake for? Even if you know the car in front is braking. And what about for our car? Do we have a good car that's going to brake in time? And what about the grip? And are we going to respond in time, right? Every day, maybe because of sleep, right, your reaction time would differ. And even though you have plenty of experience, you can never predict your prediction time precisely. So hopefully that's clear. And that's a less intriguing sort of visualization of that entire uncertainty decomposition in the context of, statistical learning or modeling framework that we actuaries are familiar with. So here, on the x-axis, we have a one-dimensional input, which could be, for example, the age of the policyholder, and y-axis, which could be thinking about the log of the claim size. So inherently, you can see we can break it down into two regions from an epistemic point of view. So the low epistemic region, which is shaded, has lots of data, right? There are plenty of data. But with the high epistemic uncertainty region, we have very few data. And if we look at the blue arrows, right, what do they represent? That they represent the variability of y at a specific x input. So even for a specific age of the policyholder, right, the claim size we're encountering could vary across time, right? That's the inherent noise in data, right? And typically, how do actuaries model this? For example, how do we know the distribution of y given x? We use GOMs, right? The idea is, okay, we see a bunch of data points. Here is a simple case where you can visualize it. But we fit, in this case, it's because the y can take all real values, you would say it's a Gaussian normally distributed. But the idea is here, you just fit a simple line, right? And in most cases, it makes really simple assumptions about this main this function you're fitting. Right, so that's the classic solution that we're dealing with. So maybe we don't need to worry about the numbers I just threw out there, like minus 0.15. It's just a slope, right, of the line. And we do not worry about dispersion or any distribution assumption for the moment. But just have this idea that essentially what we're doing is we have a bunch of data points and we're trying to fit a function, right, that could could go through those points sometimes. And now the main topic, right? What are neural networks? And essentially my perspective today is neural networks are good, powerful, we should use them, but this is the perspective you should look at them, right? They're an awesome black magic which you can just apply to any data set, let it run, and it's going to give you a good solution. What is a neural net actually, right? It's simply a function approximator. So rather than having a straight line there, right, you have a curly function which is more flexible, that theoretically, if you keep training, it can go through, it can approximate the true function, true underlying function. So here is a representation of what a neural network looks like, right? So the idea is still you have an input and there's the output. But what you're actually doing is you are going to approximate this specific function. And this specific function in the context of actuarial science usually represents the main function, the expected loss given a set of covariates. So that's just the narrative that we will be working with today. So this looking at a function approximator. Is there any questions so far? Yeah? Okay, so two components, as I mentioned. If you recall, what's aleatoric uncertainty, right? That's the part of the stochastic noise that we cannot reduce, right, during modeling. So again, let's revisit the GOM. And I'm going to take a bit of time explaining what's happening here. So first of all, classic GOMs would assume you're having a constant dispersion, right? And essentially, in addition to the plot you have seen earlier, I also plotted the standard deviation function. So when you think about what actuary is doing, typically we want to model the loss, y, right, as a distribution, right? That's going to depend, and its distribution depends on the input, x, depends on your policyholder's profile. So yes, we have seen the mean, but what we're doing in GOM is also there's a standard deviation we need to, or a dispersion we need to estimate, right? Here's a simple scenario where you have a Gaussian distribution. So you would end up with a constant standard deviation function, right? But it's not the case when you have different distributions. But I just want to present this idea of looking at things in the function space. So what we're doing is fitting two functions here. One, which is a straight line that describes the mean, the expected loss. The other one is looking at what's the variance of this loss. And on the far right, you have a plot which is at different inputs, you get a different distribution. But you can see, so the red curve, right? If you tilt your head a bit. But you see it's constant standard deviation, like the spread, right? It's the same. The only change is the mean. So you think, well, what's one improvement we can do, right? So apparently we think the variance could be dependent on the inputs. And that's exactly the idea of something called generalized additive models for location, scale, and shape. But what it does is we're also thinking the standard deviation and perhaps other things, other distributional properties, could be a function of X. So now, if you look at the middle plot here, the standard deviation roughly looks something like a quadratic, right? We think it varies across the inputs. That's what Gamless is doing. And of course, additionally, what else can we observe? We can see that the main function, right, previously was a straight line. Now we have the more flexibility, right? You can see the function wiggles a bit more, hoping to capture the true underlying function much better. And if you see the far right, which, again, right, this plot is going to show up over and over again, you see that we have different, essentially, variability, right? If you look at the red density curves. Yep, so that's Gamless. But is there an...
Do you find that these models are stable over time, or do they shift around a lot?
That's a good question. So, in machine learning, there's a concept of bias variance trade-off. So it's like usually we think a model with less bias, i.e., maybe the function is going to be more accurate, will have more variance in terms of estimating it. And I'll exactly show why we have taken that into consideration, like later on. But this is what you said was true. The GLM might have less variance when it comes to, you know, seeing what your estimate. So if you run a different time, the Gamless might give you a different estimation. Yeah. Thanks. Now, we can do better, right? There's always something we can do better. Here, you can see that the density we obtain at the end is still unimodal, right? There's a one mode, one peak, right? And also the mean function, it's still not flexible enough. So what we can do is we can take into account multimodality. So we don't need to get into the technical, right? The technical details are not the focus of the talk today. I just want to give the impression about what's aleatoric, what's epistemic, and how do we capture that? What are the different tools? So the idea here is instead of thinking there's only one distribution that's possible for this y given x, there are two, right? So two rows. And essentially, that's the idea of you having two different components, right? And the top row represents one component. You can see that's one specific shape of the mean and standard deviation. And at the bottom row, you got another shape, another pair. Now, when you actually make prediction, again, if you want to plot the density, the red density curves, you get multimodality. You can see, right, there are two peaks for some of the inputs. So this gives you more flexibility in terms. And this helps you to capture aleatoric uncertainty. Remember, this is the inherent noise in the data, right? Whether you're looking at what's the quantiles, right? What are the variances? Okay. Now, what's the issue of the MDN? If you can see, for example, if you look at the blue curve, which is the actual mean, and the density, which, you know, gives you the idea what's the distribution of the loss. What could be one concern here? So one concern would be, well, is it overfitting a little bit, right? Why does my density look like that? And this motivates us to, well, this is one of the joint work with my supervisors, and my supervisor, Professor Brendan Wong, who's present also today. So we propose something called distributional refinement network. So it's a fancy name. So the idea is that we will grab a baseline that we trust. We'll first come up with a baseline that we trust, for example, like a GLM. And then we're going to slightly refine it. Now, we're not refining the mean. We're not refining the variance, but we're refining the entire distribution. So look at the plot here. Right. You can see there are some... You can still see the GOM model, right, in the background, right? You can still see the GOM, the straight line. But what we actually, what we're doing is we think, well, maybe the GOM, as we have seen, the standard deviation in this case is constant. The main function is a straight line. It's not good enough. So yes, let's use a neural network. But two things we consider, right? Neural network, we want to make sure it considers the entire distribution, not just the mean. Not only the mean is going to change. You can also see some multimodality, right, in the input X3. But we also want to take into account of the overfitting issue. We don't want our refined distribution or our improved distribution to deviate too much from the baseline. Because we trust the GOMs, right? We trust GOMs. So we're thinking, GOM is a good solution, but just, you know, improve slightly, right? To make sure, you know, it's still something that we trust. The key idea we're proposing is this idea of distributional regularization. Everyone has heard of regularization, right? So it's, okay, can you, it's adding a penalty regarding the weights, but we are doing, it's distributionally. It's not the parameters we are penalizing. It's the deviation of, or the divergence of the densities of the distributions. So if the GOM is having, is predicting a distribution, which is, you know, has a mean which is pretty small, has pretty small variance, right? We are looking at how much we have deviated from that entire distribution. Okay. And here are two examples, right? So we of course, we respect the data loss. We want to minimize it, right? Like, for example, you can think of mean squared error, negative log likelihood, but we also add that divergence term. So on the left plot here, you have a small regularization. So which means the DRN, the neural network, can refine a lot, can change the distribution a lot. Right. On the right-hand side, you have a large penalty, which means you can't really do much. Right. You need to be sticking with the GOM. So you still see that the main function is going to be a straight line. Okay, so, but is there something that we are still missing, right? Like, suppose, right, we have a decent model, DRN, which performs pretty well, but what is one another thing that's missing, like from the earlier motivation? So it's going to be what happens, well, why do we have such confidence in the region from X2 to X3? Like, that mean function, right? Why is it somewhere around zero? Why can't the function between 2 and 3, x2 and x3, to go up or go down? And the motivation is we don't have data, right? So it could behave behave like anything, right? So that's exactly, we should have this epistemic uncertainty taken into consideration. That is, we have lack of data, right? We have lack of information between x2 and x3. And how do people do that? Well, yes, we build neural networks, right? But people think, well, if we build one neural network, we get one model, we get one mean function. Let's train three different independent neural networks, or 5 or 10. Each time we get a different neural network. You can see the weights are, that's a bit too small. But the weights are different. So, on the bottom plot here, you have the mean and standard deviation function being completely different. Not completely, right? But slightly very, right? So this is the simple idea. This is actually one of the simple solutions you can apply. And in practice, it's not too bad, right? It's not working too bad. So you can see we get high variability for the middle region of X, input X. So that's one way, right? So you get different predictions. What's another way? Well, what about we just train one neural network? But then we're going to apply something called dropout. So the idea is we're going to randomly deactivate some of the neurons. Maybe I haven't talked about what's the meaning of a neuron, but essentially you can think of every time we're going to get rid of some of the parameters. make some of the parameters zeros, okay? And which means every time I'm going to get a different architecture. And you would think different architecture leads to a different function estimate at the end. So I just want to leave this impression of what are the, well, the two easy ways of generating different distribution, different functions. Now, here we not worry about the final distribution of y given x. We're just looking at if we're just interested in what's the expected value of y given x, expected loss. Even the expected loss could differ. If we do it over and over again, like instead of 3 dropout here, let's try 10, 100, 1,000. So each time you get a different function, different expected loss function. So what do you get at the end if you run it, right, 1,000 times? You would then get a distribution of over function. So this is a slightly alien idea, I figure. So typically, actually, well, we would think, well, there's a distribution of loss, right, of a random variable. Here, essentially, it's a distribution over function. So a distribution over the mean function on the left in this particular plot. Again, I'm not going to get into the technical details like formulas. So here, one intuition is if you look at the input x equals minus 8, you can see those estimated mean functions. Remember, this is just coming from different dropout runs, so different architectures of the neural network. And you see the predictions are pretty similar. So your estimate of expected loss at x equals minus 8, regardless of what architecture you have, you can think of that way, you get very similar prediction. So which means our neural network is actually quite confident in predicting the expected loss at x equals minus 8, which is low epistemic uncertainty. In contrast, for x equals 11, you can see we have no data point, right, at that point, at that input value. So the neural network, well, should give us, as demonstrated here, right, a high epistemic uncertainty, very low confidence, which is represented by having different estimates of expected value every time. So we get a distribution over functions. Now, let's actually take a look at a simple case where it's a Bayesian linear regression, right? Linear regression, but when you go Bayesian, you just put a distribution over the parameters. But again, another idea is, well, we might want to think of things in the function space. So we have been sort of looking at things from the parameter space, for example, right? What's beta 0? What's beta 1? What's beta 2's distribution? But what about we looking at things instead of beta 0's distribution? It's actually the distribution of the mean function, right? Because at the end of the day, we are using that mean function to help us make decisions, or the variance, or the quantiles, right? But it's not the parameters that help us to do decisions, right? So that's the idea of the function space. Your function is now random. And, of course, when you go Bayesian, you have posterior is a proportional to prior times likelihood. And here you have a Gaussian likelihood. So everything is simple setup. So what do you get, right? On the left-hand side, it's a prior function space. So you can basically think, if I have beta 0, beta 1, every time I generate different beta 0, beta 1. So I get a different straight line, right? You get 1 plus 2 times x, or minus 1 minus x, different slope, different intercepts. What it does is, in the posterior function space, you're also going to get a bunch of straight lines. So even after you see the data, right, you're still going to get that. So that's the impression of, well, maybe we're thinking the prior does matter. But what is the prior actually? It's actually what we believe in the first place before seeing the data. And maybe we actually have a lot of beliefs, right? We impose a lot of assumptions. So this is something to consider. Now, we can go a bit crazy, right? Again, I'm not going to go to the technical details, but you might feel like the leading lines are too boring, right? Straight lines are boring. So there's the Gaussian process, which does nonlinear lines. pretty flexible. Again, I'm not going to introduce, well, what was GPs, but what you can see is we're going from the straight lines to something more flexible. And the key thing is at x equals zero, right, for the posterior space. So we use posterior to help us make predictions, make decisions at the end. You see higher variance of the expected functions. So again, this the plot on the right-hand side is just a principled way to get those plots you are seeing here. Like a fully something you can write down instead of something that people came up with in the first place and then tries to justify it. So this is a fully principled way. Now, why don't we do it in neural networks? So the idea of Bayesian neural network is let's try to make the weights from make the weights also stochastic. So instead of to have deterministic weights, which is given in the left plot here, we're going to have stochastic weights. So there's a distribution over the weights, right? This is essentially just stacking this Bayesian linear regression model with some nonlinearity. So, but I guess the key takeaway is we want to make sure that we can get that epistemic uncertainty, but also we want to keep some of the strengths of the neural network, and that's why we why people were originally trying to come up with this. So just making the weights stochastic, but the reality is, well, not everything right goes as what we are expecting. And the Bayesian neural networks, there are a lot of quite a few actuarial papers that look at this Bayesian neural networks in the context of actuarial applications. But what they found out is often it's even outperformed by deterministic neural networks. It's not performing well. Okay. Well, and one argument, I guess there are a lot of challenges, but I'm just going to focus on one for now. It's the Poole-Pry specification. So that's given in the left-hand side. So the left-hand side is what a Bayesian neural network's prior would look like. So that's what the on the left-hand side is what the Bayesian neural network think about the distribution over the expected loss function. You can see it's still a bunch of, you know, straight lines, and it's not cool, right? Maybe you think, why not have something on the left-hand side as our prior belief so that we can model more interesting functions? And that's, in practice, it's just the problem, right? And on the posterior function space, you still get very straight lines. Okay, so that's one reality of Bayesian neural network. And one solution we are proposing is, well, let's just try to make our prior more interesting. So essentially, you would think of this. So two things, right? Left column is the mean. Right column is the variance. So let's try to think about what the mean function and variance function could look like. That's purely from what we think, right? That's before seeing the data. So even before seeing the data, we're thinking maybe the bottom row is better than the top row. So your expected loss will be looking, yeah, you could disagree. but one thing is solution is, yes, you can always go back to the first row, or you can always come up with, there's flexibility there. You can come up with any belief you want. You can impose, right? You can explore an exponential trend if you want. But the idea is we want to specify meaningful priors, right? So something that truthfully represent our beliefs. So I'll skip what that actually achieves at the end, but you can basically think by having this extra consideration, also considering the variance on top of the mean, you get better uncertainty estimates. So if we just look at this, right, the bottom row is what we can achieve in term when it comes to make predictions, and one significance would be from the input value, probably -5 to 5, right? You see higher variability, like the prediction interval is wider, which tells us, well, we don't have much information there. So this is what happens when you go from the top row to the bottom row. So the top row, right, you're seeing some significant underfitting. Okay, but again, I'm not selling the technical details. It's just the idea of, well, maybe it's useful for us to think from this perspective rather than what my beta 1 should be, beta 2 should be. Okay, so key takeaways. From an aleatoric perspective, we want to make sure we are not only considering the mean, right? It's not always just about the expected loss, right? Like the variability, right? Different quantiles certainly matters. And, well, hopefully you can model the entire distribution. Second point is, again, function space view, right? I've been emphasizing this. So neural networks are just some more flexible function approximators. And again, overfitting issues, yeah, I'm aware, and lack of interpretability, I'm aware. So there's something, well, which lies in the middle. You can apply some sort of function regularization or distributional regularization, right, to anchor your DRN, your neural network, to something that you trust, right? That's somewhere in the middle. Now, what about epistemic uncertainty? This is a fast-growing field, right? And if you think about ChatGPT, ChatGPT sometimes had issues, and lots of the issues actually come from their ignorance or they're overlooking the epistemic uncertainty. So we want to be probabilistic about the solution space, right? So the idea is, well, we think there might be a specific solution that we prefer. Maybe I prefer the mean function to be straight lines, right? I want it to be straight lines, or I want it to be quadratic lines. Or it's more likely to be straight lines. This is the way to think about the solutions. And I intentionally put approximate. You don't have to go full Bayesian, right? And sometimes go full Bayesian, as you see with the Bayesian neural networks with the common setting, it's a nightmare. Well, because maybe I'll need to rethink that statement. Inductive biases. So this is an important point. So in the GLM, what do we assume? We assume variance is a function of the mean, right? That's an assumption. Why don't we put that into neural network? Variance is a function of the mean. Well, it's already doing some of that. But if you look at the architecture of a neural network, well, they share some components, right? But variance is not going to be directly a function of the mean. But, you know, this is sort of the idea. You can impose that assumption. And then it's specifying more meaningful priors. So in the context of, for example, loss reserving, you might have actuarial judgment assessment. You might come up with your own estimates. And they could form reasonable priors. So your solutions might be, okay, let's start with an actuarial prediction. Yeah. All right, so final thought. We want to embrace neural networks. That's what I think we should do that, but we should acknowledge their limitations. So I guess one perspective I've been looking at is, well, the GLMs are always wrong, almost, but then they couldn't be so wrong, right? It couldn't be extremely wrong. But then when neural networks, it could be right most of the times, but when it's wrong, it's horrible, right? So keep this in mind, and then we have a lot of experience, we have a lot of expertise in our field. Why don't we inform neural networks in terms of how it learns? And uncertainty in practice, that's still like open questions like, even if we get some sort of uncertainty, what do we do with them? We see high epistemic uncertainty. The model is telling us the predictions are not accurate, are not trustworthy. But what should we do then? Right? Like, if you see lots of variability with your mean function, like the bottom left, in the middle region, every time the prediction is different, what should we do? Right, that's still an open question. Now, just a bit of an advertisement. So we have already written a package which gives you all these different tools, specifically deep learning, right? So neural networks. That's going to help you to not only consider the mean, but also beyond the mean when it comes to quantifying aleatoric uncertainty. So this is a Python package, right? So you can just go to Python and install it, and then it's just roughly 5 or 6 lines when it comes to actually training one of the neural network, the distributional refinement network, right? Okay, so check it out, please. And there's also upcoming work, which is I briefly talked about the uncertainty-aware Bayesian neural networks, which is trying to resolve some of the issues with Bayesian neural networks. And so that will be in the same repository in the very near future, right? So please feel free to contact me and also my supervisors about, you know, this ongoing like project, especially around the coding stuff. Yeah. Okay. So yeah, thank you. Hopefully on time. And
thank you very much, Eric. That was really interesting. I definitely appreciated all the pretty graphs on all of your slides. I think it helped me to understand the concepts a little bit better, although I think I've still got some way to go. I've got a couple of questions coming through. So the first one was, on the point about using the ensemble of neural networks
yep.
with random dropouts, so I don't know if they're talking about combining those two ideas, when you're trying to quantify the epistemic uncertainty, you might intuitively expect the middle values of X. So I don't know if you can bring up that diagram to have high epistemic uncertainty. I think
right.
that's where there was no data. I think mm-hmm. that's what they're talking about. So how much would this estimate or quantification coming out of the model be affected by the amount of data on either side of that sort of no-go zone where you had no data?
Right. I think it's still going to be a very localized, especially with these deep ensembles and MC dropout, like these two more artificial approximate Bayesian method, it's still going to be more localized. So which means your estimate of uncertainty in the X region is not going to be significant impact on by how many points are, you know, in the other regions. But one thing to keep in mind is, again, one challenge with neural networks when you apply the Bayesian method is you don't actually know how the weights are impacting the actual output functions at the end, right? So, personally, I wouldn't give a confident answer to that, but, I would say it's more localized. So, and, typically that's why the GPs, right? The GPs might work better in practice. Like so far, compared to those approximate Bayesian method in neural networks, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
What was the data source that you used for all of your modeling, and what verification did you undertake before fitting any of the models?
Yeah, we didn't. I didn't show any of the real data set. So this, I just used a simple simple data set I synthetically generated, which is roughly 100 data points right here. In practice, when we wrote this paper, we used, I think it was the French MPTL, dataset that was focusing on, claim cost prediction. So it has roughly 2,300 observations. It's pretty heavy tailed. And, so you can check out our paper, which gives us, give you an impression of how the DRN is doing. In real life context. So, with the Bayesian neural network stuff, I'm going to use some of the machine learning benchmarks. So they have, quite a lot of classic regression data set. So this is the data set we would be using for assessing, this uncertainty aware BNNs. But we will see in the future how it applies. So one thing I'm interested in is how this particular solution could be applied to actuarial applications.
All right. I'm hoping you'll understand this next question better than I do. Can we apply KL divergence regularization to a GBM? So, for example, can we use a GLM as a base model,
yep.
E.g. The current rating structure in many insurers, to measure KL divergence from, I guess, that base GLM?
Yes, that thing just came across my mind like a few days ago. One condition only, right, is that you can from your GBM, you can get a distribution of Y given X. As long as you can do that, empirically, you can always estimate that KL divergence, but the quality depends on, well, because sometimes the distribution from the GBM might not be tractable, right? So which means you have to use some sort of approximation method. But I think practically what I see is like, maybe you don't really care about how precise, like you don't want it to be extremely precise. There's no need to be extremely precise in terms of the divergence approximation. But this is something, you know, I've been thinking about, so we can do it if there's a distribution coming out from your method. So it's more like model agnostic approach, what we are proposing, this idea of distributional regularization. And just something which is interesting, what my supervisor had found out is like the ChatGPT, when they refine their model, they are also using this kind of idea. So they come up with a baseline they have trained using some sort of base data set, database. And then when they get some more data, they want to further improve the model, they use this KL divergence. They look at how different the refined ChatGPT is to the original baseline. So they don't want it to drift too much. So this is just some interesting stuff. So like, yeah, this is a... But obviously, we didn't copy them. They didn't copy us. I don't know.
Another question that's just come through. Given the standard deviation is not a constant, what about using local stochastic volatility models used in finance to price options?
That's probably something I'm not familiar with, that term. So people, even in machine learning, right, like this is the stuff I've been looking at, they have been looking into, okay, the variance can be a function of the input in addition to the mean being a function of the input. So I suppose with those, this is still running a stochastic process. Like the Bayesian neural network, there is an induced stochastic process because it's a Gaussian process, like in a limit. So I'm not confident with my answer, but I can draw the connection here, which is the BNNs does give you a stochastic process, but you just can't write it out. It's still a stochastic process. Yeah.
Fair enough. We are right on time, but if I'm allowed just one more question,
yep.
Which I'd be really interested in, is... how can some of the models that you've talked about, like DRNs and uncertainty-aware BNNs, actually help us in actuarial practice? Can you give us any practical examples?
Yeah, so thanks for the question. So if we go to DRN, well, as I mentioned, we used a particular specific actuarial data set to assess how DRN is doing. So what we found out is in small to medium data region, right, the DRN is performing better than the MDN, right? And part of that is exactly because we were using the ChatGPT or distributional regularization idea. So the idea is that our model is not allowed to drift too much away from the baseline. So this this is sort of the inductive bias, which also relates to uncertainty-aware BNNs. So my personal view is that it's actually crucial for us to tell what the neural networks what solutions we prefer. So here it's basically we are favoring a simpler solution, right? We have a neural network that predicts a simpler solution. So, and this essentially enhances our trust in our model. So that's, again, addressing the interpretability issue. So that's why this DRNN could help us in practice, giving us more flexibility, but in the time, also, we can trust those models.
You may over afternoon tea, James, if it's all right.
Oh.
or come up afterwards. We're going to go to afternoon tea now. So thank you very much, everyone. Please put your hands together again for Eric, and we all wish you all the best for your PhD. Very interesting stuff.
Thank you.
So much.